Welcome to the Singular Links podcast. This is Tony Parrish, a.k.a. Slinker. This episode features Chapter 7 of the audiobook Singular Links. The episode explores transformation by refraction, the art of bending a familiar subject through a new lens to reveal unseen purposes. It chronicles the journey of martial arts legend Bruce Lee, who used a career-threatening injury to reimagine combat as a philosophy of fluid adaptability. Rather than focusing on rigid forms or traditional rules, this episode shows how Lee applied the principle of be like water to move from technical mastery to unconditional responsiveness. It reveals how re-seeing the fundamental purpose of a system, from physics to personal creativity, can become the ultimate engine of reinvention. I hope you enjoy Transformation by Refraction. Transformation by Refraction. It has been more than half a century since Bruce Lee passed away, but his journey from a potential career-ending injury provides a lesson for innovators, improvisers, and creators of all stripes. Lee demonstrated what I call transformation by refraction. If you only know Bruce Lee as an actor performing choreographed moves on camera, that's just one side of the story. He came from the world of real street fighting. As a teenager in Hong Kong, he squared off on rooftops, beyond the view of parents and police, where chaotic fights with other youths carried real danger. Acting on the screen allowed Lee to expose martial arts to the world, but fighting was sacred to him. At his core, he saw himself as a martial artist, not an actor. Lee would never say his aim was to be the ultimate fighter. He disliked such labels. Rather, his aim was to make combat a form of expression without pretense. Nothing added, nothing held back. He wanted combat to be the embodiment of decisive action. By 1970 in Los Angeles, Lee's acting career had stalled. His TV show, The Green Hornet, had been canceled after one season. Hollywood offered few serious roles for Asian actors, seeing him as a sidekick rather than a leading man. To make a living, he taught martial arts to private students, a mix of locals and celebrities. The work paid the bills, but fell short of the future he imagined. Approaching 30, living with his wife Linda and two children, Bruce must have realized that his window to succeed was narrowing. Then came the injury. During a weightlifting exercise, he damaged a nerve in his spine. His doctor confined him to bed for weeks and warned him he might never practice martial arts again. Suddenly, the body he relied on as a lifelong instrument could not be trusted. The stakes were immediate and personal. His identity, his ambition, his ability to provide for his family. Lee's first thoughts were practical and grim. If not martial arts, then what? Previously, he studied philosophy at the University of Washington, and perhaps he could write, lecture, or fall back on acting if roles ever arrived. But these paths must have seemed like compromises. Combat wasn't just his career, it was his identity. Without it, who was he? Could he get back? Could he rebuild his speed and strength? Horizontal in bed, he wasn't sure. For motivation, he kept a business card nearby on which he had written the words, "Walk on." Recovery required patience and careful effort. He began with small, controlled movements, testing what his back could tolerate, and slowly worked his way into light rehabilitation. The pain persisted. He had to accept that it might be a constant part of his life from now on. But the challenge was not only physical, it was conceptual. Even if he could regain his health, a larger question lingered from before his injury. His early martial training had provided a toolkit of specific responses. He could analyze an opponent. If they struck high, he would counter low. If they advanced, he would pivot and trap. But the rigid if X then Y logic of his training felt inefficient and clumsy. Memorized forms, drilled counters, and fixed sequences didn't fully prepare him for the unpredictability of combat. So even if he could regain his previous form, the question remained, how does a good fighter, even a great fighter, become the embodiment of decisive action? A few years earlier, by age 23, Bruce Lee had already developed into a fighter with blinding speed, surprising strength, and a deep grab bag of skills. He kept an open mind to anything that worked, regardless of its origin. That eclecticism laid the foundation for the legend he would become. But was he the best martial artist in the world? He didn't know if raw talent and hybrid technique were enough. Not yet. In hand-to-hand combat, being taller has its advantages, all else equal. If you're taller than your opponents, your reach tends to be longer, allowing you to strike from outside their range. To counter, your opponent must lunge forward, making him vulnerable to your counterattack. You can hit your opponent without moving, but he must move to hit you. Clearly, you have the advantage. In hand-to-hand combat, being heavier also has its advantages when all other factors are equal. Greater weight allows a fighter to use leverage to tire an opponent. Additionally, if a heavier fighter punches and kicks with the same speed as a smaller opponent, their strikes will deliver more damage. This is why combat sports like boxing, wrestling, weightlifting, and mixed martial arts use standardized weight classes to ensure fair matchups. Bruce Lee was neither particularly tall nor particularly heavy. As a world-famous fighter, standing just 5'7" and weighing around 135 pounds, he truly punched above his weight class. Lee's modest height and weight were disadvantages when facing larger, heavier opponents. He recognized this reality and devoted his training to finding innovative ways to overcome these physical limitations. The size advantage was captured perfectly in the posthumous film Game of Death. The iconic scene pits Lee, wearing a yellow jumpsuit, against basketball legend and his martial arts student, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The contrast is striking. Abdul-Jabbar stood 7'2", weighing 225 pounds, nearly a foot and a half taller and 90 pounds heavier than Lee. Possibly the greatest weapon that Lee possessed was his blinding speed. Many regarded him as the fastest martial artist of all time. His old kung fu master, the legendary Ip Man, who was born in 1893, said Lee was the fastest martial artist he had ever seen. In boxing, the term used to describe quickness is hand speed. Lee's hand speed was arguably unbeatable. That went a long way toward overcoming some of his disadvantages. Despite his below-average mass, he was able to generate above-average momentum with his exceptional velocity. There's another crucial element of speed often overlooked in fighting techniques, the acceleration that reaches its peak at the moment of impact. It's not just that the fist or foot moves blindingly fast. It's that its speed increases until the moment it strikes its target. This maximum speed happens at the point of full extension, causing the hand or foot to recoil immediately after impact, like the crack of a whip. In combat, this dynamic is sometimes called snap. Lee had mastered his snapping punch to deliver more power than a regular punch. It was also a highly efficient transfer of energy, concentrating his momentum upon impact and allowing his muscles to relax the instant afterward. This technique allowed him to conserve energy, which was vital in longer fights, where fatigue can tip the balance and retain more stamina as fights progressed. Lee knew these techniques well and devoted his life to perfecting them. On the rooftops of Hong Kong, he searched for ways to turn the attacks of his larger opponents to his advantage. He discovered ways to take their confidence and use it against them, to turn their strength into a vulnerability. This is typified in one of Lee's favorite maneuvers, called the stop hit. With the stop hit, the defender confronts an incoming attack by parrying or deflecting it and simultaneously delivering a counterattack. The stop hit can deliver a big return for a small energy expenditure because it uses the opponent's thrust against him. A stiff jab delivered to an opponent lunging forward causes more damage than the same jab delivered to an opponent standing stationary. The impact is magnified by the combination of two objects thrown together in a head-on collision. The intercepting dynamic of the stop hit was such an important maneuver that Lee later named his school of martial art Jeet Kune Do, which means the way of the intercepting fist. Lee often lured his opponents into the stop hit. In his book, Tao of Jeet Kune Do, he said, "The stop hit may be drawn in a variety of ways, by use of invitation, simply exposing targets, by intentionally uncovered feints, by making false attacks with a half lunge, or merely by stepping forward." Lee clearly wanted his opponents to attack him so he could turn their momentum against them. One of the greatest examples of a fighter using an opponent's aggression against him was the legendary Rumble in the Jungle boxing match between heavyweights Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. Early in the fight, Ali adopted a surprising strategy later dubbed the rope-a-dope. Ali leaned back on the ropes, covering up and inviting the powerful Foreman to throw punches at will. Ali bobbed, weaved, and deflected to dodge or absorb the blows, relying on the rope's elasticity to support him and cushion the impact of Foreman's punches. Meanwhile, Ali conserved his energy while shooting quick, stinging jabs back at Foreman's face. For 7 brutal rounds, Foreman expended massive energy without being able to knock out his opponent, while Ali used considerably less energy to great effect. Soon, Foreman's face was puffy, and his energy was spent. Ali, having strategically absorbed the punishment, was fresher. In the 8th round, he seized the moment, unleashed a flurry of counterpunches, and knocked out the exhausted Foreman to end the fight. Bruce Lee was a student of Ali. He studied the boxer's footwork, his nimble movement, his lightness on his feet, and his cleverness. Confronting limitations. Reflecting on his fighting technique while recovering from his back injury, Lee confronted the painful realization that his fighting system was flawed. He recognized that even when armed with a wide variety of techniques and incredible speed to deploy them, these rehearsed, choreographed moves were vulnerable to failure in real-world combat. His main critique of classical martial arts was their excessive rigidity and predictable form. Lee saw this as a liability because real fights are unpredictable. Opponents don't adhere to rules. They may eye gouge, strike the groin, or use weapons. Since codified styles only function when rules are followed, Lee's new focus became the advantage of unpredictability against an opponent who doesn't know what's coming. Every combat school had its own framework, with specific moves, rules, creeds, and philosophies. Codifying a style made it easier to teach and explain, but it also made things rigid. It drew bright lines between what was good and what was bad. Bruce saw this as a self-imposed trap. He wanted to learn from all styles, adopt everything that worked, and toss what didn't. No single tradition had all the answers. In an article for Black Belt magazine, Lee didn't hold back. "It's conceivable that a long time ago," he asserted, "a certain martial artist discovered some partial truth. After his death, his students took his hypothesis and turned them into law. What originated as one man's intuition of some sort of personal fluidity has been transformed into solidified, fixed knowledge. The well-meaning, loyal followers have not only made this knowledge a holy shrine, but also a tomb in which they have buried the founder's wisdom." Lee wasn't just criticizing technique. He was going after an entire mindset of deference to old masters, resistance to change, and worship of tradition. This is why Lee looked beyond Kung Fu throughout his career. He borrowed techniques from fencing, boxing, even dancing. He obsessed over kinesthetics, learning how to generate maximum force with minimal effort. His goal wasn't to look good, but to win, and to win in every situation, the embodiment of decisive action. The success of Lee's hybrid approach was evident even by age 18. In 1958 alone, he won Hong Kong's inter-school boxing title, the city's cha-cha dance championship, and a string of unsanctioned rooftop fights. However, his combative nature landed him on the police's radar. Worried for his future, his parents intervened, sending him to California to live with his sister. Despite his superior techniques and combat victories, Lee's most painful lesson came from a fight he actually won. As he lay in bed rehabilitating, his mind obsessed over the lingering, critical questions that match had raised about his art. A win that feels like a loss. The scene was a cramped garage in Oakland, California, a few years before the injury, in Lee's makeshift dojo. It looked like a cross between a boxing gym and a mad science lab, thanks in part to his assistant James, a welder who built sparring gear out of scrap metal. James locked the door behind them. He even kept a pistol stashed nearby, just in case things got out of hand. Sitting off to the side was Bruce's wife, Linda, very pregnant with their first child, and surprisingly calm for someone about to witness her husband fight a man who had come specifically to beat him down. That man was Wong Jackman. Wearing traditional kung fu robes, he had three associates in tow. He and Lee were the same age, both natives of Hong Kong, both obsessed with combat, both rising stars in the California martial arts scene. But they were different in two key ways, technique and culture. Technically, Jackman came from the northern Shaolin tradition, with its propensity for high kicks, flowing legwork, and acrobatics. By contrast, Lee's foundation was Southern Wing Chun, fighting in close quarters, using fast fists and redirection. Culturally, Jackman was a traditionalist. Lee was a street-fighting iconoclast who mocked the old guard. He called the masters toothless tigers, and Jackman had come to give Lee some new dental work. Back then, Lee wasn't yet famous. He was not well known outside the small kung fu circles of California, and not particularly loved inside them. He never really fit in anywhere. Born during the Japanese occupation of Hong Kong, raised under British colonial rule, and mixed race to boot, he was an outsider in every sense. The traditional schools of Hong Kong even frowned on teaching martial arts to anyone not 100% Chinese. Lee's first teacher, Ip Man, quietly trained him anyway, but didn't advertise it. Lee's mixed heritage was an open secret, one the kung fu world wasn't quite ready for. This subtle exclusion lit a fire inside Lee. He began to view the so-called purity of tradition as a kind of dogma. The way he saw it, that dogma wasn't designed for better fighting, but for gatekeeping. He hated that. Ip Man, to his credit, encouraged his students to test their skills in the real world, not just practice forms in the studio. Lee took that advice to heart. In Hong Kong, real-world sparring often meant rooftop fights, spontaneous, gritty, and very illegal. Lee loved it. He learned quickly that traditional training left holes. Fighting wasn't about executing clean, rehearsed sequences. It was about adapting, improvising, and surviving. Fast forward to the Oakland garage, face-to-face with Wong Jackman. By then, Lee had refined his eclectic approach into a blend of styles and philosophies, all fused into a personal, practical system. But that night, the fight didn't go as planned. Accounts vary on what exactly happened. Most accounts say that Lee won the fight, but not in the way he had hoped. Jackman remained evasive, forcing Lee to chase him around, burning more energy than expected. Lee gassed out like George Foreman in the rope-a-dope. Despite the victory, it felt wrong, sloppy, inefficient. Most of all, it felt hypocritical. Lee had spent years bashing the classical schools for being impractical. Now, his own system had failed this real test. That stung deeply. But here's the twist. Jack Mann did teach Lee a lesson, just not the one he intended. He didn't prove he could beat Lee, which was what he came to do. He proved Lee's evolution wasn't finished. After the fight with Wong Jackman, Bruce Lee hit a wall. It wasn't a physical wall. That would come later with his back injury. Rather, he hit a mental wall. The win didn't feel like a win. It gnawed at him. His performance had been chaotic, exhausting, off balance. For someone obsessed with control and precision, that stung. It shook him hard enough to direct him inward. He started asking bigger, tougher questions. What makes a fighter truly great? What kind of style can handle anything? So he pushed himself harder than ever. He overhauled his training, added new techniques, ramped up his stamina work, and he pushed so far, so relentlessly, that he blew out the nerves in his spine. Remember, at this point, Lee wasn't the global icon you probably know. He was mostly just that guy who played Kato on The Green Hornet, which had already been canceled after one season. No big kung fu blockbusters yet. No international fame. Just a struggling actor, an obscure martial arts instructor, and now a father of two with a potentially career-ending injury. With much of his days spent in bed convalescing, he began writing, studying, and thinking about the assumptions underlying his art. He got curious. What good was the value of fixed forms, repetitive drills, and encyclopedic technique when the particulars of combat threw unpredictability into every battle? As Mike Tyson later said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. Lee soon came to realize that a fighter's greatest weakness in combat is the failure to adjust to new developments. Raw skill, strength, and speed were necessary, but insufficient. He began to view martial arts as less a collection of moves and more a principle of movement, something fluid, flexible, and responsive to whatever it encountered. What tied together speed, strength, and technique was adaptability. Combat is improv. Viewed through this refracted lens, the decisive action fighter wasn't the one who was the fastest, or the strongest, or the one who possessed the largest library of techniques. The decisive action fighter was the one who adopted the principle of movement itself, being fluid, flexible, responsive. And during that long, uncertain recovery, Lee made a breakthrough. He stopped asking how to be the best fighter technically and started asking how to be the best fighter without limits, how to be the embodiment of decisive action. And then the metaphor came to him. Be like water. Water doesn't oppose structure. It flows around it. It adapts. It absorbs. It crashes. For Lee, the phrase, be like water, wasn't only a metaphor. It was a framework for his evolution. Lee had always been drawn to the way water could move, advancing, retreating, crashing, flowing. But now he saw something deeper. Water's real power isn't in how it moves. It's in its formlessness. It doesn't cling to shape. It takes on whatever form the situation demands. Through this insight, Lee's philosophy of Jeet Kune Do emerged. It wasn't so much a new school of martial arts as a philosophy of formlessness, absorbing what was useful, discarding rigidity, and creating a personal, adaptable expression. Lee began to view combat as more about responsiveness than domination. The change was conceptual, but also decisive. In his own words from his book, Jeet Kune Do favors formlessness so that it can assume all forms. It uses all ways and is bound by none. In this art, efficiency is anything that scores. Against predictions, Lee managed to slowly rehabilitate his back, regain his physical conditioning, and return to his previous form. The months spent reflecting offered lessons that no amount of sparring could provide. Only now did he possess a deeper understanding of how a martial artist could transform into the embodiment of decisive action. Initially, he had applied this be water mindset at the technical level, with redirection, energy conservation, flowing from strike to strike. But now he saw it at the macro level. Not just how to fight, but when, why, and whether to fight at all. Consider his garage fight with Jack Mann, an opponent who came specifically to teach Lee a lesson. If Lee had truly embodied his be water philosophy that night, he would have let the moment dictate the engagement. Instead, Lee chased and forced the fight, directly betraying the philosophy of fluidity and adaptability he would later champion. Years later, in Black Belt magazine, he said, "There are no prearranged sets or kata in the teaching of Jeet Kune Do, nor are they necessary. Consider the subtle difference between having no form and having no form. The first is ignorance. The second is transcendence." Sounds like a Zen koan, doesn't it? But the message is simple. To have no form is to be responsive. Not passive, but aware. In combat, that awareness becomes your edge. It's not just about technique anymore. It's about the situation. In the movie Enter the Dragon, a bully named Parsons tries to provoke Lee's character into a fight on a boat. Lee declines, famously stating his style is fighting without fighting. When Parsons presses him further, Lee agrees, but insists they need more space. He points to a lifeboat and suggests they row to a nearby island for the demonstration. Puffed up with aggression, Parsons climbs in. Bruce simply unties the lifeboat and lets the brute drift away, leaving him stranded at sea. No punch thrown. Fight over. That is the essence of fighting without fighting. And in the same movie, during the Hall of Mirrors finale, Lee finds it difficult to distinguish his real opponent from the dozens of mirror reflections. His opponent knows the room and has the upper hand. So rather than pursuing blindly, Lee shifts tactics. He begins smashing the mirrors, removing his opponent's advantage, fighting without fighting. What Lee discovered is that winning a fight isn't just about power or speed or even skill. It's about seeing. It's about reading the room, viewing the terrain, the intention, the missteps. Recognizing that the real battle might not be the one in front of your fists. Eventually, this philosophy culminated in a general theory, a theory that could adapt to any situation, that could absorb new evidence and still hold true. Lee thought he'd already built that theory before fighting Jack Mann, but the Oakland fight proved his framework was incomplete. His technique worked, sure, he won. But the energy expenditure, the lack of control, exposed the gap between theory and practice. So he adapted. That's the concept of be water in action. It's about taking in the big picture and considering what's really happening here. When you zoom out like that, when you can step back from the details and see the whole dynamic, you stop being just a technician. You become a strategist, a philosopher. Transformation by refraction. Bruce Lee's journey from a potential career-ending injury provides a crucial lesson for innovators, improvisers, and creators of all stripes. Lee's reinvention illuminates this principle. The term refraction describes what happens when you transform the purpose or meaning of a familiar subject by seeing it through a fundamentally new lens. Lee's subject remained martial arts, but when refracted through the principle of water, it revealed new dimensions he had previously failed to see. Lee took something rigid, centuries-old rule-bound combat, and reformed it. Where others saw mastery as perfecting a set of moves, Lee saw it as dissolving the need for fixed moves entirely. This was an improvement, sure, but it was also much more than that. It was a conceptual domain shift. It moved the purpose of martial arts from mastery over a system to mastery over the immediate situation. This shift created the singular link between fluid dynamics and combat philosophy, giving Lee a new approach to martial arts, a kind of syntax for adapting rules based on the environment. In physics, refraction is the bending of a wave as it passes from one medium to another. In innovation, it is the model where you take your subject and bend it to give it a new purpose. Examples of this conceptual shift are everywhere. On a grand scale, Copernicus refracted the solar system by placing the sun, not the earth, at the center. Einstein refracted gravity, turning it from an invisible force into the curvature of space-time. The core idea remains the same. Refraction is invention by re-seeing, not just by addition. Henry Ford refracted the purpose of the automobile, changing it from a luxury toy into mass transportation for average households and giving cars a new meaning in society. Computer manufacturer Apple popularized the graphical user interface, GUI, refracting the computer's purpose from a tool for calculation and programming into a device for personal creativity, communication, and accessibility. Recently, I was in a toy store where I saw several examples of refraction. The Slinky is a spring that's usually used for storing energy, but its purpose is refracted as an entertaining toy that can walk down stairs. A flipbook refracts pages of static 2D images to create the illusion of motion. I saw cardboard puzzles engineered so the pieces can be assembled in three dimensions to create animals, reptiles, and insects, refracting the original idea of the 2D picture puzzle. Transformation by refraction is the art of bending what already exists through a new medium of thought, revealing unseen purposes and possibilities within the familiar. The operations found on a common pocket calculator offer many examples of this principle. When you apply standard mathematical functions to a number, you are essentially taking the identity of that number and creating a new identity. Each operation serves as the refracting medium. If you start with the number 4 and apply the square root operation, you're essentially asking the question, what value, when multiplied by itself, results in 4? The answer is the number 2. Applying the squaring operation to the number 4 refracts it differently. It answers the question, what is the value of this number when multiplied by itself? The answer is the number 16. Similarly, the factorial operation asks the number to represent the product of itself and all possible integers preceding it. The answer is the number 24. In every instance, the fundamental form of the subject, the number 4, is transmuted. The calculator function is the refracting lens that fundamentally changes the subject's purpose. The final results, 2, 16, and 24 respectively, are completely different from the original 4, but they maintain an absolute logical connection to it. This dynamic perfectly mirrors transformation by refraction. The subject remains the same, but by being viewed through a new conceptual medium, its ultimate form and meaning are changed. Bruce Lee's transformation ultimately teaches that true mastery is achieved not by adding more to an existing system, but by refracting the fundamental purpose of the system itself. Lee took a physical discipline, centuries of codified martial tradition, and viewed it through the lens of fluid dynamics. By doing so, he bent its meaning, shifting the focus from perfect rigid technique to unconditional adaptability. His ultimate lesson for innovators across all fields is to treat obstacles, shortcomings, and even victories that feel incomplete, not as roadblocks, but as the refracting media that force a change in perspective. The process can reveal the simplest, most efficient, and most effective path forward. Now that we have explored some of the Sultans of Slink, and we've seen how Lee, West, Close, and Shannon created transformation in different ways. The next step is to incorporate their lessons into your areas of focus. In the next part, we'll look at how to train your eye to recognize singular links in your surroundings. That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to explore more ideas like this, you can find much, much more at singularlinks.com. If you're feeling frisky, tell your friends and family, in-laws and outlaws. Music was provided by the Slink Tones. Until next time, connect the unconnected, create the unexpected.